This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 88.3, 89.5, 92.5 from Bloomington to Pontiac in good old Central Illinois. And you, yes, you can help our station. You can make a donation at CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And help us to expand. We've just expanded up into Pontiac. We are trying to expand a little bit to the south, and hopefully maybe something along that line will work out in the next year or so. At any rate, you are a key player in the game because we are brought to you by you. So be faithful, be traditional, and be Catholic. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, today, and we're going to have a great show for you. And we talked about that last week. And Lynn is going to do a segment on the church fathers, doctors, and talk about that. And maybe talk about a little bit of a comparison to that age of the fathers to this age that we're in today, and see that many of the issues and things that we face are no different today than they were then. And the church had to face those things, and we have to face those things today. So as we start, I'm going to ask Lynn a little bit about the fathers and doctors. Exactly what does that mean when we say church fathers or church doctors? I mean, who are they and how do they qualify? How does this all come about?
The church fathers, there are two classes of them. And the first class is the apostolic fathers of the church. We have many of their writings. In fact, in the divine office, every day is read one of their instructions or things about the fathers of the church, of the apostolic fathers especially. These men, people, were acquainted with or personally knew one of the apostles. Sometimes they were kind of like apprenticed to them, and they assisted them and so on and so forth. So they were there from the very, very beginning of the church. The second group that we just call fathers is like the next generation, where the apostolic fathers and the fathers of the church both lived through the first through the second century. So they had an opportunity, apostolic fathers, to interact with the apostles. Now, the fathers are the ones who didn't really know the apostles, hadn't met them personally, but they had followed the teachings of the apostles as given to them by the apostolic fathers. Is that understandable, Bob?
I think so. I was going to ask, in other words, the doctors of the church are a little bit different in a sense. I mean, they can overlap. You could be a doctor of the church and a father of the church as well.
Yes, or an apostolic father that doesn't interact. But the fathers of
the fathers go back actually
to the very beginning.
In other words,
the doctors of the church don't necessarily go back that long.
Yeah, they're more like some of the saints, like Thomas Aquinas and Augustine and so forth, who lived at a later time.
Yeah, they could have. They
but
could
nevertheless have, mm-hmm. taught well and advanced the doctrines of the church, and so are considered doctors of the church. A little bit of a different term there, more of a teacher maybe?
Yes, they are teachers, or they taught us. They left something behind. These are people that lived very holy lives, devoted to God totally, and left behind things that would instruct us on how to get to where they were.
Exactly. And so the fathers pretty much go back to antiquity, and that's one of the tests for being a father is in touch with antiquity. And also orthodoxy. I've always talked on this program about, if you want to really be radical, be orthodox.
That's right.
And so,
that's right.
So the fathers advanced the doctrines that were handed down by Jesus Christ to the apostles, and then they were passed on from the apostles to their successors. And it was the fathers, a lot of the times, that we call the people of fathers, very close to the apostolic times, who continued to formulate and teach and hand on those doctrines.
Yes, that's exactly right. The doctors, the last one that I know of that was named a doctor, there are 35 of them, is Teresa, St. Therese of Luxor.
Okay, St. Therese of Luxor.
So she was in the late 1800s that she lived.
Sure enough.
She's the last one, I believe, that was named doctor of the church.
And then, so it would be antiquity, orthodoxy, and then you mentioned especially for the doctors, but it would be for the fathers too, holiness, you know, a dedication to holiness.
Right.
And of course, you know, holiness means to set apart.
Right.
You know, to
set aside, to come out of the worldly life, the life of materialism and so forth. You're called and set apart, to be set apart, so that you can really develop your relationship with God.
But that's exactly what holiness and sanctity means, is to be, you know, those who are set apart, those who set mm-hmm. themselves apart. And, you know, again, that goes back to tradition. And, you know, we talk about that on this program, and it goes back to orthodoxy. To be traditional and to be orthodox is to set ourselves apart from the society often that we live in. And it doesn't mean that you're not in the world, but you're not of the world. And so you have to stand somewhat apart and take a little bit different position. And that gives you the ability then to lead. And the template, the mentors for that are the fathers.
That's right. Now, I did mention the divine office, or it's called the Liturgy of Hours. We're going to go into this part. In the second segment, we will talk about the consul, the first consul.
Okay.
Okay.
We're having a consul going on right now, you know, as we speak.
Yes, and we thought this would be a good time to maybe talk
right.
about the consuls.
A consul
the
is
first
ending.
Consul.
So we will talk about the first consul of the church. And the church was actually, we have to remember that Constantine beat Maximus. Maxentius, rather, I should say. Constantine defeated Maxentius, you know, at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312 AD. And Constantine fought that battle under the auspices of Christianity. He had this vision that, you know, Christianity was the coming thing. And his wife, I believe, Constantine's wife was a Christian. And he did not believe in persecuting the Christians, and although the Romans up until that time had been. And then Constantine fought Maxentius, you know, for the emperorship, or, you know, for the Caesarship, I guess, of Rome, and defeated Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge in 312 AD. And then in 313 AD, Constantine declared that Christianity would be legal, and he also more or less legalized as long as people weren't acting against the, you know, Rome and against the laws and so forth, that he would be tolerant of various religions. But of course, he especially favored the Christian religion and made and legalized it in 313 AD. And then there were various, you know, right off the bat, various sects of Christianity began to spring up, and there were deviations from the teachings of the apostles and the teachings of Jesus that were handed on. And one of the worst ones at that time was Arianism, what was called Arianism. And there was a priest in Egypt, in Alexandria, called Arius. And that priest declared that there was a time when Jesus Christ was not. In other words, Jesus Christ came into existence. And if Jesus Christ came into existence, then he had to be a creature. I mean, something can't come in existence unless it is created, where the word creature comes from, you know, a created thing. And so for there, Jesus might have been the greatest of all creatures, but nevertheless, if there was a time when he was not, that is, if the Father, you know, God the Father was first and the Son second, then the Son came into existence and therefore he had to be a creature, and maybe the greatest of all creatures, but nevertheless a creature. And of course, that really tore the church asunder. And it resonated a lot, especially with pagans who had, you know, come into the church, because their concept of God, you know, was like many gods, but on the other hand, there was a one God or great spirit that created everything, and the idea of the Trinity was hard to swallow. And so Arianism seemed to solve that problem, so a lot of people became Arian. Even Constantine sort of leaned in that direction. But at any rate, Constantine wanted the church to have a council so that it could resolve that question, because he did not want, you know, this kind of division in his empire, and he wanted them to come together. And to be fair to Constantine, he kept his hands off. He didn't try to influence it. But the council then was called in 325 A.D., and it was held at Ephesus and in Turkey. And,
it was in Nicaea.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong. No, it was in Nicaea. It was called the Council of Nicaea. You are correct, Lynn. I was getting ahead of myself talking about something else there. But it was held in Nicaea. It was called the Council of Nicaea. And most of the bishops there, there were about over 300 bishops attended the council.
Yes, there were over 1,000 invited.
Yeah. And
was a universal council.
Exactly. Most of them were from the East. Most of the bishops were from the East. But it was actually Hosius, who was a bishop from the West. You know, he was from Cordoba, Spain. And he presided over the councils, even though most of the people there were Eastern. And he had two Roman priests with him from Rome. They were with him, and they represented, he and the two priests represented Pope Sylvester the First, and who was the Pope at that time, but didn't attend the conference. I think maybe because of health reasons it might have been that he didn't attend, or he had other things to do and attend to. But at any rate, he sent Hosius and his two aides, and they were Western, they were from Rome. And so the conference was held mainly to solve that problem. It did some other things as well. I can name some of the people there. Eusebius of Caesarea was there, and that was in Palestine. And he is considered, Eusebius, the father of church history. And Eusebius recorded some of the, I might, you know, mention some of the things that Eusebius recorded because it's sort of important. He recorded the effects of the Roman torture, you know, not long before this council. The Christians, especially in Rome and wherever Rome, you know, was powerful, were being persecuted right up until, you know, pretty much up until this time, until Constantine took over. And he recorded the effects of some of that torture, you know, that was going on prior to Constantine. And Paul of Neo-Caesarea or Euphrates had his hands burned with hot irons. He was there, and so his hands were sort of useless, burned with hot irons. You can see some of the things that were being done to these. Another man there was Paphnutius of Upper Egypt, and he had a gouged out eye and had to have help in walking. His knees were crushed, had been crushed, one of the things that they did to him. And then another Potamon, who had an eye torn out, was there, that Eusebius records by name. And then some of the other things that were recorded that had been done to these people was they had been scraped. I don't know exactly what that means. I would imagine their skin, you know, being scraped off.
Yeah, it makes you shudder.
Yeah, they were racked. That is, put on a rack, you know, and you're tightened up the rack and pull you tight, and, you know, and mm-hmm. stretch your joints and bones. And they were flogged. Some of them had been flogged. Some of them had been burned. Some Christians had been starved, and they showed the effects of the starvation upon them, and some starved to death, of course. Others were crucified. Some, in a way, lucky, as Paul, I guess, were beheaded. Who knows, though, if they might have been tortured first. And some of them were drowned. These are just some of the things that were done. And then Eusebius says, and many other tortures, some too gruesome to mention. I can't imagine anything being more gruesome than those, but, you know, evidently they were. So Eusebius even recorded, he said, it seemed to him like a dream to be meeting in pomp and splendor, you know, sponsored by Rome. In other words, Constantine sponsored this, and he provided, you know, very beautiful and luxurious quarters for the meeting to take place in and for these people to stay in. And, you know, they were having food and drink and all of that. I mean, you know, it was like, it seemed just as if maybe they had died and gone to heaven or something. It was like a dream to be all of a sudden everything be turned around like this. So it gives us a good idea of what the early Christians went through and what, you know, what they were willing to do rather than renounce their faith.
That's right. These men really, as you can tell by Bob's description of what they came looking like, these poor ragged people that had been tortured so badly, it's what they looked like. But they stood up from the very beginning for what they believed. And to round this segment up, I would like to read to you about Polycarp. He was St. Polycarp, the Bishop of Smyrna, and was a disciple of the apostles. That means he was an apostolic father. He accompanied St. Ignatius of Antioch to Rome to confer with Pope Anastasius concerning the celebration of Easter. About the year 155, he suffered martyrdom by being burned at the stake in the amphitheater at Smyrna. And what you're going to hear is from the letter on the martyrdom of St. Polycarp by the church that was present when this happened, when they were there to witness it. When the pyre was ready, Polycarp took off all his clothes and loosened his undergarments. He made an effort also to remove his shoes, though he'd been unaccustomed to do this, for the faithful always vied with each other in their haste to touch his body. Even before his martyrdom, he had received every mark of honor in the tribute to his holiness of life. There and then he was surrendered by the material for the pyre. When they tried to fasten him, also with nails, he said, "Leave me as I am. The one who gives me strength to endure the fire will also give me strength to stay quiet and still on the pyre, even without the precautions of your nails." So they did not fix him on the pyre with nails, but only fastened him instead. Bound as he was with hands behind his back, he stood like a mighty ram chosen out for sacrifice from a flock, a worthy victim made ready to be offered to God. Looking up to heaven, he said, "Lord, Almighty God, Father of your beloved and blessed Son, Jesus Christ, through whom we have come to acknowledge of yourself, God of angels, of powers, and all creation, of all the race of saints who live in your sight, I bless you for judging me worthy of this day and this honor, so that I may die for you." When he had said amen after he finished praying, the pyre was lit. But when a great flame burst out, those of us privileged to see it witnessed a strange and wonderful thing. Indeed, we have been spared in order to tell the story to others. Like a ship's sail swelling in the wind, the flame became as it were a dome encircling the martyr's body, surrounded by the silver hot in the furnace, not like flesh that had been burnt. So sweet a fragrance came to us that it was like that of burning incense or some other costly and sweet-smelling gum.
We're going to have to take a break here and stop there. Stay with us. We'll come back and talk more about the council and some of the things they resolved. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Bloomington Central Catholic, a U.S. Department of Education Blue Ribbon High School. So the academics are great, but why do the students love it?
Everyone is just so close. Such a small school.
Catholic because it's a place where I can be me.
We have such great faith life.
Go to Mass, reconciliation, whatever I want.
Or take the Washington Post's word for it. It's the most challenging high school in Central Illinois. Your child belongs at Central Catholic High School, 661-7000, 661-7000.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We've been talking about the Church Fathers. We've been talking about the first council, the Council of Nicaea, that was held in 325 A.D., and the council was held mainly because of the Arian heresy, the idea that Christ somehow or another was a creature, the greatest of all creatures, but nevertheless a creature, that was splitting the church, and the council was called to resolve it, of course, which it did. We'll get into that. We were talking about the people that were there, the bishops, and how many of them showed the effects of torture. And of course, as Lynn pointed out, the death of Polycarp shows us that even though Constantine ended this and made Christianity legal, there was a return to persecution after Constantine's time, and some of the church fathers, and others of the church were still subjected to all kinds of torture and other disgraces and so forth that was heaped upon them. So it wasn't over. Christians suffered for a long time. But Lynn will go ahead and talk a little bit more about the council and some of the things that they resolved.
The agenda of the council of the synod included the Arian question, which Bob has already talked about, the date of the celebration of the Easter, the various matters of church discipline, which were resulted into 20 canons, organizational structure of the church, focused on the ordering of the episcopacy and dignity standards for the clergy, such as issues of ordination, how it's to be done, and how they should behave. It's still a topic today. Reconciliation of the lapsed, establishing norms for public repentance and penance, readmission to the church of heretics and schismatics, including issues of when ordination and or baptize were required, and liturgical practices, including the place of deacons and the place of standing at prayer during liturgy. These were the things that they gathered together to discuss and decide.
And I might mention that when you said 20 canons, that canon means rule. And that's exactly what the church was establishing. And so you can see from the very beginning, the church assumed that it had the authority that Christ gave it to resolve various issues, as long as they stayed, of course, within the doctrine that was handed, a tradition that was handed on to them by Jesus to the original apostles and then to their successors afterwards. And so you go back and you find that the church is Catholic right from the very beginning. The council was called to resolve these issues, and everybody there assumed that the church, did have this authority, and that the Pope had the authority to call a council and treat with Constantine, with an emperor, and that kind of thing. So you're right from the beginning, the church was hierarchical. It was a hierarchy. It was not some kind of a democracy or a bunch of Christian different groups all acting on their own in different places. Its objective was to make them all one. And that's why, this was being held and why they did that.
The results of the debate ended up with the council declaring that the Son was true God, co-eternal with the Father and begotten from the same substance. We express this still to this day in the Mass when we recite the Nicene Creed.
Exactly. We say begotten, not made. In other words, that Christ was not a creature. And Christ was, with the Father and the Son, proceeds from the Father and the Son right from the very beginning.
It also concluded that Jesus Christ is described as the light from light, true God from true God, proclaiming his divinity. It decided that Christ should be said he was begotten, not made, because he's not a creature. Body is creature-like, but his substance of God is with him, and he is part of the God-being.
They actually coined a new word, the homoousios, and it was a word based on a very similar word. This word had an iota in it that the other word did not. An iota is what we would call an I today, and that's where we get that term sometimes. There's not an iota of difference between this and that. In other words, by putting that little iota in that word, the word came to a new meaning, meaning that Christ was of one substance with the Father, one and the same. And that's a brand new word that they coined in order to get that into the creed to make sure that people understood, you know, that the Arian heresy was declared, you know, over by the church, although it persisted for another 300 years. And we still have Arianism among various groups today, the Jehovah Witnesses being one, you know, talking of Christ as actually being a creature. The Mormons also, I think, reinstituted it in the sense that, you know, everybody, human being, you know, Christ started out once like we were, God started out once like we were, and that kind of thing. So it keeps on cropping up. All the old heresies always crop up all the time. You really can't invent any new ones.
Also, they went on to separating the celebration of Easter and established that it would be celebrated on the 14th day before the spring equinox. No, that's not right. They chose the month of Nisan, choosing a month whose 14th day fell before the spring equinox.
Well, I know they resolved it came at a formula for Easter, and that formula was based on lunar months and so forth. And we still use it to this day. That's why Easter moves around a lot, because the old Jewish
movable feast.
Yeah, the Jewish calendar, you know, was a lunar calendar, and so therefore it has to be readjusted from time to time. It did it. New months have to be stuck in there and that kind of thing. We didn't get our calendar that we have today until, what was it, Pope Gregory, was it? The Gregorian calendar.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so,
right.
You know, then before that, there was the Julian calendar, which got off.
That was by the Roman Empire, yeah. Julius.
So the church was certainly not against science. I mean, four of the big cathedrals that were built in the Middle Ages were all used for astronomical and scientific experiments. I mean, the church built, you know, the whole edifice of science and universities.
But okay.
It started with something like this. I might mention also that there was Alexander was there. He was a bishop from Alexandria, and he had with him a young priest named Athanasius, or rather, he was a young bishop at that time, Athanasius, and Athanasius and I think Alexander also stood against Arius, and so Arius was overwhelming. The judgment against Arius was overwhelming. Almost everybody there rejected this Arianism, and Athanasius went on to become a champion of orthodoxy. In fact, Athanasius was called Athanasius Contra Mundum, and that meant Athanasius against the world. Is what his name became.
Yeah.
He lived for another 50 or 55 years, more than 50 years, I think, he lived after this conference in 312 A.D., and he was sometimes exiled out to the sticks. I mean, now he was exiled to France, which was nothing but a wilderness. And so when he was in those places, he would make converts and build churches and all that kind of thing, always advocating solid orthodoxy. And eventually, he prevailed.
Right. At this point is when they separated away from the Jewish calendar. Because if you remember, the first Christians, many of them, most of them, the apostles, were Jews. And they followed the Jewish calendar, which was a 10-month cycle. Many of these early disciples would go to the Jewish synagogue on Saturday, and then on Sunday they had their own gathering where they celebrated the Mass. And by the way, we do have a description of the Mass. It goes back to the year about 150 B.C.?
150 A.D., yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Can't have it B.C., it's
no,
going to be A.D.
But,
and it follows the same pattern that we have today, the very same. You can read about it in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Exactly. That's how Cardinal Newman, you know, Cardinal Newman was an Anglican priest, and the reason he converted over to Catholicism was he began going back and studying the history of the church, and he went back century by century looking for where the Catholic Church deviated from its doctrines and so forth, and where it went off the rails. And he couldn't find it. He went all the way back to the further back he got, the more and more, in a way, frightened he became, because he began to realize that the Catholic Church was the church of the early Christians. And the further he got back, he realized the earliest Christians were Catholic. And he realized the church had come into existence and was in existence for a long time. Even at 312 or 325 AD here, you can see by the behavior of this consul that the people there were behaving and acting as if they took all of this for granted, that it had been that way as far, for all of their lives, for example, and for people's lives prior to that. In other words, long before there was a New Testament and so forth, the church had been baptizing, it had been creating saints, it had been building churches, it had been offering the sacraments, it had been doing all the things that it is doing today.
Okay, what they finally ended up with was the promulgation of canon law, which we have been handed down to us. Number one was the prohibition of self-castration. Kind of surprised me, but you got to look back at the times and what Paul had said and so forth, and you can get into that in the New Testament. The second was the establishment of a minimum term for catechumens. That means those studying to be prepared to receive the sacrament, especially of baptism. They established what it would take to get them to that point and how long it should take. Three, the prohibition of the presence in the house of a cleric of a younger woman who might bring him under suspicion.
Yeah, that's an issue that we have, of course, even today, scandal. In other words, you shouldn't be doing things that cause scandal. But it just goes to show you that,
the same problems.
And how much the church gave us. I mean, just imagine this. Back at that time, you were having a world conference, because this was the world back then. The Roman Empire was pretty much the world. And you were having this with over 300 bishops from everywhere in meeting and deciding on things that laid down all of the basis of Western civilization, law based on Christianity and Christ, law based on the idea that we were made in the image of God, Imago Dei, setting down principles that became necessary to establish the basic of science and universities and everything else. It was incredible. It built Christendom, which became Europe.
Right. And to go on, number four was the ordination of a bishop in the presence of at least three provincial bishops and confirmation of this ordination by the metropolitan bishop. And we still do that today. A bishop cannot be ordained unless there are three other bishops present. And they have the permission of, like, the metropolitan bishop would be like the archbishop of a diocese.
And just think about that. Just think of what you have in your church. When you are looking at your priest, you are seeing a person who had hands laid on him, who also had hands laid on them. And we can trace that succession of hands all the way back to the very beginning, all the way back to the time of Christ. What other institution in the entire world has an unbroken history like that? And has handed on the same doctrines without change for over 2,000 years all over the world. That's what Catholic means. It means, in effect, universal, worldwide. And that term came in. I think it was it Ignatius that created that term, Catholic. I think it might have been about 150 AD or something like that.
Somewhere in there, I did have it written down somewhere.
Yeah, he said, I think there's a statement going back. It's the first time we use the word Catholic. It's a Greek word spelled with a K, Catholic. And he said, if you go into a new town, find the bishop. And when you find the bishop, there will be the Catholic Church, meaning there will be the universal church. That's the first time we hear it. But if he was using it in 150 A.D., it had to go back a lot further than that. That's just the first time we find it written down.
That's right. That's right. And number six was the confirmation of two ancient customs, giving jurisdiction over large regions of the bishops of Alexandria Rome and Antioch. You can see how the religion had, how it had, Christianity had spread out into the different continents even. The recognition of the honorary rights of the See of Jerusalem and prohibition of usury among clergy, precedence of bishops and presbyters.
I want to comment on that usury real quick, if I can, Lynn.
Could all
I
right.
have time to do that? And the reason I want to comment on usury is because so many people today have this idea that usury, you know, usury is just this idea of paying interest. You know, and that somehow the church condemned it. The church did not do that. What the church condemned was taking a, you know, charging a fee without an entitlement to it. That's what usury was. In other words, if you were a wine merchant and somebody borrowed a bottle of wine from you, you could expect him to pay it back with the profit that you made on that wine. In other words, let's suppose the wine was a dollar and you sold it for a dollar and a quarter. When the person gave it back to you, he would pay you back the dollar and a quarter because you were entitled to make 25 cents on the bottle of wine because that was your livelihood. You know, and so when that wine was gone from your stock, you weren't selling it to somebody else. But if you gave that wine, if you were just a neighbor, another Christian, and you had a bottle of wine in your house and it was just an extra bottle of wine that you weren't using, then if you lent him that bottle of wine, you weren't expected to charge him anything because you weren't entitled to it. In other words, you wouldn't have made anything on the wine. So if he pays you the wine back, in other words, a dollar, or gives you back the exact, you know, same wine, then the debt is canceled because you shouldn't be making money on something you're not entitled to. You wouldn't have made any money on it just sitting in your house. So that's what usury was confined at. At any rate, we're starting to get down toward the...
We've got a couple more to go, but if you'd like, we can pick it up after the break.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take a break here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
God doesn't send anybody to hell. We choose hell. What God is doing is allowing our free will choice. He never wants us to say no. He always wants us to be in love with him. And people need to understand, after we die, you only got two choices, heaven or hell.
Beauty.
Smoking or non-smoking.
Exactly.
That's it.
Morning Glory with Gloria Purvis, Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, and the Morning Glory team.
Monday through Saturday at 6 a.m. on Catholic Spirit Radio.
Do you listen to Catholic Spirit Radio?
I sure do.
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do listen to Catholic Spirit Radio.
Yes, I do.
Whenever I have the opportunity.
Yeah, I listen.
Of course I do.
Very much so.
Yes, of course I listen to Catholic Spirit Radio.
When do you listen to Catholic Spirit Radio?
In the morning
or my lunch hour.
After school, during my downtime, or on the weekends.
On my way to and from work.
I listen in the car.
Usually I'm on my way to church, and I listen again on the way home.
I listen to Catholic Spirit Radio in the middle of the night when I wake up and I can't sleep.
Tell others to join the growing number of Catholic Spirit Radio listeners. You can hear them on the air, online, on the free app, and on Alexa. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Follow them on Facebook and check out the resources on their website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break, and we were talking about the Council of Nicaea and some of the things that the church did there. Of course, Arianism was the big issue, but once they had resolved that, there were many other issues. As Lynn mentioned, they were talking about fixing the date for Easter. They were talking about ordination. They were talking about the liturgy. Lynn was talking about that they defined usury. And I think also, didn't they address an issue of how to bring apostates back into the church?
I think you're right. But I don't see it here listed with those things, but yes, they did. Because they did talk about, you know, how you bring people back, in what order, where was that, be number,
well,
anyway,
yeah,
it's in there. It's under one of these topics.
I think the problem with that, weren't there a lot of people who, you know, of course, some people had suffered.
They're very confused, too.
Yeah, and they were angry with people who left, and, you know, they didn't think they should be brought back into the church without some kind of, you know, trial by fire, so to speak, or punishment or something like that. Wasn't that the case? Because they were saying, look, we've been tortured, and we didn't give in, and some of these other people, they gave in, and nothing even happened to them, and now we don't think they should be back in the church.
Yes. Yes, and keep in mind, these consuls went on for months.
Exactly.
And months.
And so the church finally declared that if these people repented, confessed their sins, and that they could then be received back into the church, because Christ had said, you know, to forgive not just 7 times, but 70 times 7, meaning, you know, your forgiveness should have no limit. If people are repentant.
Right. They also decided on the precedence of bishops and priests before deacons in receiving the Holy Eucharist. So, I find that kind of wondered what was going on, that they had to establish this. But I guess it makes sense.
It makes sense because, you know, there were a lot of people that we would call them sort of like Puritans today, or, overly scrupulous people. And they were saying that, you know, some of the people were charging, and this was a heresy too, pronounced as heresy. They were charging that if a priest or a bishop, you know, were guilty of grave sin, you know, not something just lightly, but of grave sin, then the sacraments that they were confecting were not valid, and the church had to deal with that issue. And so they said, no, that even if a priest is guilty of grave sin, nevertheless, he is a priest forever, and the sacrament he's confecting is still valid. You can take it from him and receive a valid sacrament, even if he himself, you know, is in effect bringing down calumny on his own head, bringing down condemnation on his own head. It is not, you know, passed on to you. And that's what the church resolved, and they had the authority to do it. So a lot of those things, you know, that we have in the church today were resolved at this very first council.
Yes. Can you imagine? Most of this we still stick to, we still follow. And then there's the declaration of the invalidity of baptism, especially by Pauline heretics. And I'm just not familiar. I don't remember what the Pauline sect of the church were teaching at that time.
It didn't have anything to do with Paul, you know.
No. It was his followers. I think they...
It was...
I just don't remember, and I can't go on about it.
You sure you're not talking about Apollonism? I forget.
I don't know.
There was a...
I'm just reading what it says here, a declaration.
I'm looking for it here. There was a heretic named, I think, Apollo, and I'm trying to... I don't see it here, but I forget what they were teaching. But, you know, it was another heresy. They dealt with a lot of them, and there are so many.
Oh, yes. There was a list there of all the heresies they dealt with at that time. And I can imagine how confused people must have been.
Yeah, they dealt with the Marcion heresy, and, you know, that this was a heresy that God of the Old Testament was not God of the New Testament. You know, there was a difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. The God of the Old Testament was sort of like an authoritative, sort of a dictator, dictatorial type God, and the God of the New Testament was a forgiving God and so forth. All of that had to be resolved, so they resolved that. But there was another one, I think maybe Apollonism, and I forget what that one was, but it was by a guy by the name of Apollo, and they resolved that, the Manichaean heresy, the idea of sort of a dualism, you know, that material is bad and spirit is good. They had to resolve that, and they said that, no, everything that God made was good, and God himself used material. I mean, Jesus Christ did in his work. I mean, he used mud, and he used water, and he used his own saliva. One woman was cured through the touch of his clothes, and so on. And it goes all the way back into the Old Testament that material was used to transfer power and sacraments. And so they said material could not be bad. It's the intent and the will that is bad, not material. Our bodies are good. It's our will that can be bad.
Yes, and you're right. They did talk about and decided what the reconciliation of the last people, those that have fallen away, the heretics and schismatics, including issues of when reordination and rebaptism, if they were to be required, and under what circumstances. So you're right there. That was under one of the other top headlines. The final one was to do with liturgical practices. And one of the practices was the prohibition of kneeling on Sundays and during Pentecost, the 50 days of Easter. Standing was the normative posture for prayer at this time, and still is with Eastern Christians. Kneeling was considered most appropriate when you were doing penitential prayer, as it made it distinct from the festive nature of Easter and its remembrance every Sunday of Easter. The canon itself was designed only to ensure uniformity of practice at the designated times. I don't know why, but that kind of fascinated me. When you look at the old cathedrals and stuff, they've built so many centuries ago, there are no pews in them.
No, the people stood. They could kneel. I mean, they could kneel down, but they didn't. You know, they just kneeled on the floor, or else they stood. That's true. And it just, like I say, the thing that you do see here is the difference between tradition, sacred tradition with a capital T, traditions that Christ handed down that must be taught and must be observed, and then traditions on how to go about doing those things. And those traditions are with the smaller T. In other words, how should we go about, you know, doing the worship that is required of, you know, God? It is required that we worship God. How should we go about it? Well, they chose the Lord's Day to be on a Sunday. They didn't choose, they didn't change the Sabbath. The Sabbath today, to this day, is still on a Saturday. You know, the Jews observe the Sabbath on Saturday. But the Lord's Day was considered Sunday because that's the day he rose from the dead. And so the church, you know,
it began the new covenant.
Right. That is a tradition with a small T. How should we worship Christ? To worship him is a tradition with a capital T, the sacred tradition. But how should we go about it? The church was able to set the parameters for doing that. And we have all of those with us, you know, to this day. And those, of course, those smaller traditions, they can be changed depending on the circumstances. All of these things were laid out very early, 325 A.D.
So. Right, and that was amidst all of these persecutions. There were quite a few persecutions, one after the other, by the Romans
too. Oh, yes, there were.
Put down this new group of people that looked at them and said, they're going to cause insurrection and disturb the peace of Rome.
Because traditional Christianity is countercultural. It teaches,
in other words,
it's authoritative and it's hierarchical, but at the same time, it's based on love and charity, love of your neighbor and charity. And it was a whole new thing in the world, you know, and so emperors and so forth and people around the state feared it because they thought it would lead to disobedience. It doesn't, because the church taught to obey authority. In fact, you know, it's all authority, you know, comes from God. And this is what Jesus Christ said. He even said to Pontius Pilate, you wouldn't have any authority if it wasn't for my Father in heaven.
Okay, and when they talked about liturgy, they were talking about the public prayer of the church. That's what liturgy means.
Right, it means
the public prayer of the church.
Right.
It's when we all get together and celebrate the Mass together.
Right, it's a public act is what, you know, the liturgy is. And then I wanted to get the word in here, ecumenical. This was an ecumenical council, wasn't it?
Yes.
And what that means.
And this one today is, too.
Yeah, and this one we're having today is, this council that's being held in Rome is an ecumenical council. And what that means is it means pertaining to the whole church. Ecumenical did not mean back then, and it doesn't mean in the case of the council today, is pertaining to everybody. It meant pertaining to all those people who belong to the church. And so pertaining to the whole church. And so we have ecumenical today, meaning somehow or another, you know, trying to incorporate even religions anymore, it seems like, that are even non-Christian religions or something. And you know, and that's not what ecumenical originally meant. It meant pertaining to the whole church rather than say, just an issue in a parish or an issue, say, in a certain geographical diocese location or a diocese or whatever the case might be. You know, those are not ecumenic. Ecumenical means pertaining to the whole church. So we got that also.
And the first liturgical prayer of the church is the Mass, and it is the oldest. As I say, you can look in the catechism, and it will tell you exactly what they did on Sundays, very much like what we do today. The second form of liturgical prayer is the Divine Office. Now, this goes way back to the Desert Fathers even, and it's a collection of psalms, readings of the apostles, and the church fathers. All of them are included in the liturgical prayer of the church. And the Second Vatican has encouraged even lay people to do this, to read these when you have, you know, for us it'd be more like when you have time. For those under religious orders, they usually follow their own orders, set way of doing it, but they still do it. And the ordained deacons do the morning and evening prayer, and the priesthood requires that they do all 7 hours of the prayer. It's divided into seven that they call hours of prayer, so that we are praying constantly, as Paul said, to pray constantly.
And the other thing that the church established, I've gotten here in my notes, is it's important, is that you can see how they used the authority, and that you can see that it goes back, because they didn't say, we have decided at the council. They said the Catholic Church has decided.
It has been decided.
Right. Yeah, you know, in other words, it has been decided by the church. So they were acting as a church. And so they were not acting just as a group of people separate from everybody else. They were acting as the whole church on behalf of all the people that were in it. And they assumed this authority just, you know, it was just taken for granted that they had this authority. So you can see it wouldn't have been assumed or taken for granted unless it went back all the way to the very beginning. And that's how the church had been operating from the very beginning, as a hierarchy with, bishops and so forth, deciding things and given that authority originally by Jesus Christ when he said to Peter, you are rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And he told him, whatever you bind in heaven will be, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you forbid on earth, that is, whatever you loose, that is, whatever you forbid on earth, whatever you bind on earth, meaning whatever you forbid will be forbidden in heaven. And whatever you loose, whatever you allow, will be allowed in heaven. In other words, he gave Peter that authority, and Peter, represented the church. He was the head of the church and the rest of the apostles, and so it was handed on down. And you can see it right there, 325 AD, in the Council of Nicaea, all of those things operating just as Jesus Christ intended. He didn't leave them with a book. He left them with the church.
That's right, and it's in its whole complete. It's all there.
And so, Catherine.
Really hasn't changed all that much. There are local customs and so forth that variance. But at one time, a Catholic in the Latin Rite of the Church could go anywhere in the world and participate in the Mass, and it was done in Latin so that everyone could participate and understand what was going on. You know, we have since Vatican II changed to the normative language of the people in that area, in their own areas, their own countries. So we've lost that in a way. I kind of miss it.
It was nice. And, of course, at one time Latin was, it wasn't that long ago in our own lifetimes that Latin was taught. When we were kids, you could take Latin in high school.
Yeah, I did.
And Latin was a second language, and much of the known world, right? And much of the words in English to this day have Latin, stems and roots.
And why did they choose Latin? Because it's a dead language.
It was a dead language. It wouldn't change. They chose it so that they could fix something, define something in Latin. And then the definition would hold. It wouldn't be constantly, they wouldn't have to constantly update it, because our words change. I mean, a lot of the words, the word worship, for example, at one time, 150 years ago or so, worship meant to honor. It didn't mean what it means today. In England, they still say your worship sometimes when they're referring to a judge, meaning your honor. Here we say your honor. But the word worship changed. And now what used to be called adoration is now called worship. So if you have language that changes, you have to constantly be on guard to update it. With the Latin, you didn't have that. And so that's one of the reasons. But at any rate, they went on to address many other heresies as well. A heresy is, just a false teaching. And a person is not a heretic for advocating false teaching if he doesn't know any better. It's only when a person knows better and decides to stand outside the church and defy it that he's a heretic. In effect, that's pretty much what it means, is you're standing outside the church. And you get some of that today. You get people today that instead of going to their Catholic mass, they're Catholics or call themselves Catholics, they will go to a Protestant service. And the fact is that, the church has the authority to decide how and when and where you should worship. And this authority was given to it by Jesus Christ. And when people say, well, I disagree with the church, you're disagreeing with the authority handed to it by Jesus. And so you're disagreeing with Christ. And you should remember that. And you owe your God your worship. And it has to be done according to the way he laid out, not the way we would like it to be.
Yes.
So at any rate, we're going to have to stop here.
I did want to add just one small thing. If you want to follow the Liturgy of Hours, there you can get the books. You can get the 4-volume set, and then there's a 1-volume set that's the Christian Hours, and another volume which is only shorter Christian prayer, so that you can follow with the prayer of the church. You want to follow it online, you can go to usccb.org and pick it up there. And many other places.
With that, we're going to go ahead and close. And so we'll go to our closing prayer. St. Michael the Archangel,
defend us in battle.
Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen. God bless everybody out there. Please pray for us. We'll pray for you. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.